Welcome to the Department of Justice Agency in Focus, sponsored by Leidos.
Hello and welcome to the show. Law enforcement produces some of the most stressful jobs. Through its Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, or COPS, the Justice Department monitors the mental health of state, local, and tribal law enforcement and the programs that support it. For highlights of the most recent findings, I spoke with Deborah Spence, the Assistant Director for Training and Partner Engagement.
Historically, one of the things that we have done is look to the field to help guide the field at large and use promising practices in some jurisdictions and share them with the rest of the field so that they can learn and adopt from them. I think as more departments explore ways to implement this, that yes, we will start working to document ways that they're dealing with mental health checks in their department, of whether that's an annual, is that post-event, is that just periodic check-ins through your career. I think there's lots of different ways that people could do this.
Sure. And getting to the topic of crisis lines, those are a little bit more understood, I guess, and more common, certainly in the veteran space for suicide prevention. What characterizes crisis lines in law enforcement?
It's actually very much the same thing. One of the things that the Veterans Crisis Line does is that when you call, you are going to speak to somebody who also has military experience. And there are law enforcement crisis lines, and they work exactly the same way. It is either active law enforcement or retired law enforcement that are on the other end of the phone.
And that report, getting to the larger issue here that the COPS office put out on the mental health state of law enforcement, I mean, what are the big takeaways that you think are important there?
We really have three major takeaways that we hope everybody will get out of the report. One is that good mental health is just as important as good physical health to being able to do this job. It's a difficult job to do. There are long hours involved. You are dealing with people who don't necessarily want to be talking to you, or they're having their own personal crises. And officers face that on top of the fact that all of us can really face workplace and family stressors that, you know, make us have bad days at work. Also, that there actually is a lot of good work being done out there by agencies and organizations to support law enforcement mental health. But it's often disjointed or complicated by insurance coverage and privacy concerns and problems with people not always really understanding the professional culture of law enforcement. And third is that there isn't just a single solution. There's no one, you know, this program will solve everything. This is something that will have changing needs over the course of a career and maybe even to the type of jobs that you're doing within your department. And so the more that we can work to build whole health programs that integrate both physical and mental health, as well as education and prevention and programs for officers and their families, the healthier that officers will be and our communities will be.
Sure. And I want to come back to some of those issues and how mental health programs might apply to federal law enforcement. But first, let's back up one more step and just give us a sense of the methodology by which the Justice Department is able to assess something as amorphous as the state of mental health in law enforcement across the country.
Yes. So for many years, we've worked with an officer safety and wellness group where we bring in 40 to 50 professionals two times a year to talk about issues regarding officer safety and mental health. And so we had a number of people that we knew we could call on that had previously talked about a lot of these issues. And a lot of those people that attend those meetings are advocates of improving our work in this area. Then specifically for this report, we set up consultative interviews with current and former police chiefs, officers, representatives of labor organizations, affinity groups. We talked to a number of federal law enforcement agencies just to get their ideas on what was important in this field and what were the key issues and what were some of the programs that they were aware of. And then there also is a companion case studies guide. We had another organization that we worked with. They went out and recruited case study sites through national labor organizations to find some example programs. And it was interesting to see that a lot of the things that come up in those case studies really dovetailed with what we were hearing in our consultation interviews.
Yes, because I guess a lot of care has to go into the choice of the case histories. Some of the towns you covered, Bend Police Department, I don't know about Bend, Charlotte, Mecklenburg, Dallas, Indianapolis, Las Vegas. So a variety of even climates and situations and characteristics of different cities. How does mental health, do we know, tend to vary depending on the size of the municipality? I mean, are the issues in Jaffrey, New Hampshire, where I used to work, the same as New York City?
I think it may many cases, yes, actually. The same issues that we would hear when we would talk to people in smaller agencies really mirrored the big agencies and even the very large federal agencies. You know, there's a constant need to be vigilant. You're dealing with long hours, shift work. I think if there's differences, they tend to be more related to job assignment or even to the sort of geography of where you're patrolling. That you could work for a large state agency or even a federal agency, but if you're out in a very rural location, you know, you could be hours from any backup. You might be patrolling on your own. There might not be very many other people on at any given time. Whereas in a major city or a suburban urban area, your department could be small, but you know, assistance is minutes away. So I think there are differences, but I think the bigger differences are really related to the services that agencies can provide. When smaller agencies are not going to have the variety of psychologists and psychiatrists at their disposal, their peer programs, if they have them, are going to be smaller or run in conjunction with other agencies, whereas a large city agency can have pretty comprehensive services housed within their department structure.
Deborah Spence, the Assistant Director for Training and Partner Engagement at the Justice Department's Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, or COPS. More after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
At Leidos, we have supported the U.S. Department of Justice for more than 40 years with unwavering commitment. The department takes on the toughest public safety and law enforcement challenges, and they don't take risks when it comes to technology and legal expertise. From enterprise IT modernization and litigation support to strategic communications and cybersecurity, Justice counts on Leidos to deliver innovative solutions. Learn more about our shared mission at Leidos.com/DOJ.
Welcome back to our interview with Deborah Spence, the Assistant Director for Training and Partner Engagement at the Justice Department's Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, or COPS. And talking about federal law enforcement, and there's a great deal many more federal law enforcement agencies than I think the average person in the public realizes. Almost every department has a police force. And did you look at the mental health issues and the status of just the federal sector in this report?
We didn't as a separate group. In talking to them, they really raised many of the same issues that our state and local people did. So we chose to structure the report around the global realities of challenges to mental health. What we did acknowledge is that the ways that a federal agency might go about addressing those problems might be different. One, in terms of that they do have a larger infrastructure and common insurance providers sitting behind their services. And two, that there are different security clearance concerns that are raised. And that was actually something that came up in a variety of our federal interviews, of that people, one of the barriers to seeking help is fear that you would lose your security clearance, which would impact your ability to do your job.
Sure. And we should note that, yes, your mission was to look at state and local, not so much federal, because this is the Community-Oriented Policing Services Office. So just wanted to I guess there is also some mobility among agencies for if you're in law enforcement, you can work at a lot of different law enforcement agencies and feel like you're at home.
Yeah.
It's that kind of profession?
Yes, very much so. It's a one of the things that we talk a lot about is the importance of providers to really understand law enforcement culture. And part of that is the very community nature of agencies. And they talk about a brotherhood, a family. And that is very true. I think in many respects, that's one of the things that is similar to the armed services, is that sense of community amongst people who serve and their family members.
Sure. Yes. Yes, indeed. If you've ever known any cops, you know, that's exactly how it is. And it's good to be with them when something comes up. And what about the issue of the changing nature of societal expectations, changing culture? I mean, if you look at, say, just something like the Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C., once characterized by a mayor named Barry as an occupying force. Today, very, very different socioeconomic situation in the city, different problems. How does mental health change over time, or maybe how do the stressors of mental health change over time?
I think that one of the things that we talked to a lot of people about was that officers are asked to do a lot. They, in many communities, are truly the face of local government. They're who you're going to talk to about anything. And it could be your noisy neighbor. It could be a family member in crisis. You could be having a mental health crisis. They have to be able to deal with that regardless of what it is. Over the course of a career, that's a lot of different traumatic experiences that you're going to witness, whether or not they, you know, impact you in the moment, just the cumulative effect of those can wear on a person. And at the same time, they're trying to balance that against, you know, shift work. They might be an understaffed agency where they're doing a lot of overtime. That puts pressure on their families and their home life in terms of being there for their spouses and children. And so I think over the course of the career, you could really have ebbs and flows in how you're feeling and how you can cope with situations that stack up one after another. You don't get a lot of time to decompress between days and calls.
Sure. And earlier you mentioned Veterans Affairs, and what you just said reminded me of this idea of PTSD. If you are in a combat situation, especially over a period of time, you might see things that even if you are not injured personally, you might see a lot of situations that in seeing them cumulatively could have an effect on your mental health, could produce PTSD, we now know. Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe that's less understood for law enforcement, which after you see 100 car wrecks or 100 bodies splattered in the road, it may seem routine, but maybe it really is not so routine.
I think that's very true. In recent years, we have had more and more conversations about the extent and nature of PTSD in the law enforcement community and working to recognize that that is a problem that we need to be conscious of, and also to recognize that there are a lot of veterans that come into law enforcement who might already have seen and witnessed traumatic things in other situations, and to not presume they're a blank slate when they come into this department. The volume of conversations that we have around cumulative stress and post-traumatic stress has really increased dramatically in the last couple of years. So I think we're going to start to see more and more research on the extent and nature of it in law enforcement.
Sure. And I want to talk about some of the case histories here for a minute. One is Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. They have a program called PEAP. What is that, and what can we learn from a program like that?
I think one of the things that is really clear in all the case studies, and Las Vegas in particular, is the importance of buy-in from the officers. That program was really developed not from a top-down or an outsider coming in with a great idea, but working with the officers in the department to figure out what they need and what they would be willing to access.
And what does it stand for, by the way?
PEAP is the Police Employee Assistance Program.
Oh, okay. So, an EAP with police on the front.
Yes.
Common term.
EAPs are pretty common in law enforcement, but they often are run at the municipal level, common to all municipal employees.
So
in that
a tax
community.
Clerk would have the same EAP as a policeman.
Correct. So one of the things that Las Vegas is doing, and you do see it in other places as well, is really having a very police-focused EAP.
And benefits of that are specializing in the sense of the people delivering services.
Yes, absolutely. There's a common story that we hear, and you know, maybe it's not true. Maybe it's the same, you know, thing that everybody likes to tell. But they give the examples of officers talking about a particularly traumatic case to a civilian behavioral health specialist who broke down crying hearing about the scene. You know, law enforcement want to be able to speak to somebody who has some sense of what they're going to see before they go into that meeting.
So. Sure, yeah, and that raises an issue also in common with Veterans Affairs. And there is often the assumption only a veteran can really understand what a veteran goes through. And I think in the psychiatric community, there's some dispute about that, that people can be trained such that they can gain the trust of and have the understanding of someone that has been in combat or been on the front lines of police and homicide and whatever else they see, riots, that if you only limit that to the people with a similar experience, you might be leaving out a huge body of professionals that could be of help. Is that part of your working?
Yes, absolutely. We think of, you know, the clinical psychologist who was also a 20-year beat cop is a bit of a unicorn, right? There's not going to be that many people that can do that. So interestingly, one of the other things the Act asked of us is to work with the Department of Health and Human Services to build resources for community-based clinicians to better serve the law enforcement community. And we talk about that in the recommendations report, and some of the case studies do as well, that there are ways to bring civilian professionals into that world, to send them on ride-alongs, to meet the officers, to spend their time, we use the word embedded, in those departments and in that work, and to build those relationships that will make them accessible to officers and give officers the sense that they understand something about the nature of this work. I think absolutely.
And I did want to ask you about the Bend Police Department. That's the only city I'm unfamiliar with in this whole list. It's not South Bend.
No, Bend, Oregon.
Bend, Oregon. And what type of town is that?
It is not a very big town. They have just about 100 sworn officers. I actually think they offer one of the more promising ideas in the case studies report, not so much in a specific program sense, but in terms of a philosophy or an approach. Chief Porter in Bend talks about how we should think about our investment in officer wellness, and I actually made a note of a quote. He said, "We expect officers to perform like athletes physically. We expect their minds to be sharp like doctors in stressful situations, and we work them ridiculous hours. If we want officers to be effective and efficient in their jobs, we must support their wellness holistically." And I think the rest of that case study really goes to show how he did that. It wasn't about what are his ideas of what might be helpful. It was really about talking to his officers and saying, what do we need to continue to get up and go to this job every day and do it well and enthusiastically? And they've really come up with some creative programs.
Yeah, because I think that maybe more interaction with the public in a normal sense might be able to help. I've often, well, the example I use is standing at intersections during road races where there is police presence because it's a busy intersection. And I've been at intersections with, say, two or three cops local in where I live here, you know, in Montgomery County. Nice gentlemen, sometimes nice women, mostly men that seems to be out there. But they only want to talk to themselves. And here I am, just a civilian standing there with a red flag, you know, you guys tell me where to stand. And sometimes I think there's a barrier that is set up by just circumstances, whereas, you know, everybody's just folks.
A couple of years ago, I got to speak to a group of law enforcement explorers, kids high school, college age that are interested in law enforcement careers. And one of the things that we wound up talking about in that conversation was this idea that once you're in the job, you can't forget that your car or your uniform are an informal barrier. People in a uniform with body armor on and weapons and radios, they are slightly more intimidating to approach and converse with. And if they're not conscious of that as well, if we aren't both conscious of that reality, yes, they wind up talking to themselves and we talk to ourselves. One of the other programs our office has supported over the years is called Coffee with a Cop, and it is just supporting opportunities for community members to come and talk to their police officer about anything. And when we talk to officers who run them, they love them because it's a chance to just sit and chat with people. I've actually been to one in Arlington County and talked to some of the officers at one of those events, and it was really fun to get that moment of realizing that they're just my neighbors, even if their uniform makes them stand out in a crowd.
Deborah Spence is the Assistant Director for Training and Partner Engagement at the Justice Department's Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, or COPS. More after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
At Leidos, we have supported the U.S. Department of Justice for more than 40 years with unwavering commitment. The department takes on the toughest public safety and law enforcement challenges, and they don't take risks when it comes to technology and legal expertise. From enterprise IT modernization and litigation support to strategic communications and cybersecurity, Justice counts on Leidos to deliver innovative solutions. Learn more about our shared mission at leidos.com/DOJ.
Welcome to the third and final segment in our interview with Deborah Spence, the Assistant Director for Training and Partner Engagement at the Justice Department's Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, or COPS. And let's go over the key recommendations in the report. I mean, that's where the rubber hits the road, so to speak.
So we have 22 recommendations in the report, and we really strove to focus on guiding principles rather than specific program details. The more that we can get everyone on the same page in terms of understanding the risks to mental health that is inherent in this job and some of the common barriers to service access, the better. I think one of the most important recommendations in the report is the one regarding improved privacy considerations for officers seeking assistance. Making that decision to seek any kind of mental health care could be difficult for all of us. I mean, it's a field that we don't have regular interaction with the way we do your regular doctor. Right?
Sure.
So now consider that in the case of a law enforcement officer, they would reach out to a crisis line or a peer support program and then just find out that that information is discoverable in court proceedings. It could even affect their employment eligibility. We often think about, HIPAA protects our private health information, but that doesn't apply to a peer support program. That applies to medical professionals and insurance companies. The idea of chaplaincy programs with their clergy penitent privilege, it's not entirely clear that would apply to lay staff working underneath that chaplain's purview.
Sure.
So if we're going to encourage officers to take care of their mental health, they really need to have confidence that what they say to any service provider is not going to be subject to disclosure to the chain of command or in judicial proceedings.
And I imagine there has to be some thought given to how these programs are set up physically. That is to say, if there is an EAP, that's police EAP, you don't want it in the main corridor with a glass wall to the office where everyone could see who's sitting with the counselor, for example.
Exactly. And I think in some of the case studies, they do talk about them being housed at training academies or in private office space nearby departments. But yes, absolutely. And I think also when we start talking about smaller agencies, having regional collectives or statewide organizations or even national lines are important to give people another way to access services in a way that feels more private and confidential than something that is run by their agency.
Was one of the recommendations maybe seeking help in another jurisdiction, just where you have objective ears, perhaps, that may not be familiar with a situation locally?
We do have a recommendation around building collaborative relationships around support programs. It does happen informally in some instances where a larger agency will also advertise their services to smaller nearby jurisdictions. And I think that's important to promote both in terms of privacy concerns, but also in terms of how do you help very small agencies who can't necessarily staff their own program themselves. If you work in one of the 50% of agencies with 10 officers, who's your peer in your agency that you're going to talk to? Everybody's going to talk to the same guy. You know, how do you run a program in an agency that small?
And what happens to the report next and all of the case histories and all of the recommendations?
So I think we're going to be having a lot more conversations in the field about where we go next with these recommendations. We have already started speaking at a number of conferences directly with law enforcement. The printed versions have just been released, so we'll be taking them around on our conference tours. We really want to get people talking about how do we make these recommendations work in a real sense. If you look through them, they tend to have very short write-ups. They have a principle. They don't have a cost. They don't have a step-by-step guide. So now it's about talking to the field about, okay, how do we make this real? What is it that you need? One of the things that we are doing this year is we have a funding program available for building and enhancing law enforcement peer programs, and that is in response to these reports and the original act.
Sure. And what is your own law enforcement background?
My law enforcement background is working at the cop's office. I've been there for about 15 years. I have never served in uniform, but I really respect what they do and have enjoyed this career working in a program that tries to help them do their job better.
Deborah Spence is the Assistant Director for Training and Partner Engagement at the Justice Department's Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services, or COPS. To hear this interview in its entirety, visit federalnewsnetwork.com and search Agency in Focus. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Department of Justice Agency in Focus, sponsored by Leidos on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.
At Leidos, we have supported the U.S. Department of Justice for more than 40 years with unwavering commitment. The department takes on the toughest public safety and law enforcement challenges, and they don't take risks when it comes to technology and legal expertise. From enterprise IT modernization and litigation support to strategic communications and cybersecurity, Justice counts on Leidos to deliver innovative solutions. Learn more about our shared mission at Leidos.com/DOJ.